are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, November 19th, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Michael D'Antonio, journalist and author of The Shadow President, The Truth About Mike Pence. Also on the program today, midterms nearly resolved. Senate and governor in Florida called for the Republicans as the Democrats destroy the Republican Party in California. Just gone. Meanwhile, in California, as the wildfires still rage, 80 now dead, hundreds still missing, Trump puts his grievance and ignorance in the forefront. And as the CIA fingers Mohammed bin Salman in the Khashoggi killing, Trump sticks his fingers in his ears. Nancy Pelosi under fire, looking at a potential leadership challenge, and her proposal to change a House rule is perhaps one of the best reasons to challenge her, but from the left. McConnell kills the so-called bipartisan criminal justice reform bill. That was fun while it lasted. And Ohio's stunning gerrymandered state house to bring the worst conservatives have to offer. Meanwhile, Julian Assange may be close to prosecution in the United States. And only because I'm so old, I remember coverage of the Obamas. Melania Trump's $200,000 hotel bill for a Toronto day trip. All this and more on today's Majority Report, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah, that Melania Trump story.
I mean, well, what's the exchange rate?
That's a good point. That's a good point. Favorable to you, those of us in the United States. So, but I don't know. Those stories tend to get a little petty. But I, like I say, only because I remembered the relentless multi-year project that was reporting on Michelle Obama's trip to Europe, that I even mentioned those things. But more importantly, I want to do this story up top here, just briefly. We had mentioned it, but as I read it, it was also flagged for us by a listener who sent us an email. You've seen the story. The email puts it into a slightly different, a different context. This is from listener Mike, who apparently worked in Congress at the Congressional Research Service. And so he would, from time to time, provide incoming House and Senate fresh people, you know, just a how to work your way around the Congress from, I guess, from a bureaucratic standpoint. And so he flagged this, and this story is out there. There are now 17 incoming Democratic freshman representatives who have signed a letter saying that they will contest Nancy Pelosi as Speaker of the House. An 18th has also committed to that. She has not signed the letter. I think it's Spanberger who beat Dave Brat. I haven't looked at the entire list of the 17, but the vast majority of them are to the right of Nancy Pelosi. All right. So with that said, and I think that's a problem. I don't want a Speaker of the House who is to the right of Nancy Pelosi. And I think people who have listened to this program for an extended period of time, I'm far more interested and think it would be far more helpful for the Democrats to replace Chuck Schumer, who I think is relentlessly bad and incompetent and worse, particularly in light of the recent revelations about his essentially moonlighting for Facebook. But there have been two things about what's going on, or three things that really stick out for me in terms of the Pelosi thing. Is one, that for those of us on the left who want to see a change in the Speaker of the House, it's important to make sure that we get something better. Now, that sounds a little bit less sexy and, in my mind, sort of basic. But there's a lot of people who lose sight of that. And I'm not convinced yet that there is a candidate on the left who can win. Remember, because the Republicans vote in this for the Speaker of the House. It's just ostensibly that you need a certain amount of Democrats to maintain the majority. So Republicans could theoretically vote for a candidate, a more right-wing Democrat. They probably would vote for more left-wing. I mean, they would rather Nancy Pelosi because they've dedicated a significant amount of resources and time to demonize her. But to the extent that there is a reason to get rid of Pelosi, for me, the biggest reason for me in the past has been her stated support prior to the election even for PAYGO. What is PAYGO? PAYGO means that anything that the Congress passes, any programs that they vote for and pass, must be offset in terms of their cost. Pay as you go. No deficit spending. This is absurd from a policy perspective. It is absurd from a political perspective. There is no constituency out there for PAYGO.
I was listening to, or reading Democracy in Chains again. The Libertarian Koch brothers are big fans of PAYGO and have been for decades.
Of course, because it constrains spending. And so Republicans get in, and this is the game that's played. Republicans get in, they increase the deficit, then they immediately find, after they've done this, they immediately find a more fiscal responsible profile. And that's the way that they use it. You know, they attempt to leverage the cutting of Social Security and Medicare, et cetera, et cetera. So PAYGO is a problem. And to set that as a constraint, it is almost like it's a transcendent policy insofar as it impacts every other policy and every other ability to push a progressive agenda. There's now a proposal in a change of the rules to the House, because incoming leadership gets to change the rules of how the House operates. You could do it every year at the beginning of the session. It is proposed by Pelosi and Massachusetts Representative Richard Neal. It would, quote, require a 3/5 supermajority to raise individual income taxes on the lowest earning 80% of taxpayers. Now, that sounds all well and good. First blush, it's like, yeah, good. Increase the taxes on the top 20%. Don't raise them on the rest of the country. The only problem with that is, as you start to realize it, particularly in light of PAYGO in particular, you take a whole host of progressive policies off the table. Right now, that bottom 80%, incidentally, along with the top 20%, is paying essentially the lowest income tax burdens in the history of the country. Well, maybe not the history, in modern times. since at least, let's say, 75 years. I suspect it's actually longer than that, but let's call it 75 years. And what it basically does is it says it takes off the table all of these progressive initiatives and prevents Democratic representatives from having to make a so-called tough vote to raise taxes on people in the middle class and theoretically living in poverty. It just puts unnecessary constraints that are really there just to protect people from taking votes that are meaningful. If the Democrats want to actually pass a rule that is helpful in terms of, let's say, populist policies, then institute a three-fifths supermajority needed to cut Medicare or cut Medicaid or cut Social Security. And now this, again, wouldn't be a problem if Nancy Pelosi hadn't been so adamant about PAYGO. If the Democrats came in and said, like, we have no problem adding to the deficit, and let's punt this. If the Republicans are so concerned about fiscal responsibility, let them raise taxes on everybody when they eventually take the House. So this is really problematic. And, you know, this is a fight. I don't know how much people outside of Congress can really influence. But good thing to tweet at freshman representatives that you're aware of this. And to tweet at representatives, don't handcuff yourselves. We are putting you there to vote on and to pass. And obviously without the Senate, none of these things are going to become law. But it's important that Congress puts their stamp on it now. We want you to pass progressive legislation. And anything that's going to stand in that way, do not vote for, like these new proposed rules. Important to have some awareness of what, you know, the depth of these issues. The other stuff about that you hear from the left about Nancy Pelosi, largely, I think, is just misinformed. I'm in favor of new leadership in the House, but not at the cost of having someone more conservative there. Nevertheless, like I say, there are some reasons to find real problem with what Nancy Pelosi is doing. That proposed law, it strikes me, is a gift to the right. The best argument for the left agitating to unseat Nancy Pelosi is so that she feels she has to give stuff to the left rather than give stuff to the right. You need to balance out the pressure that's coming from the right. So, all right, let's look into just some of these videos of Donald Trump making an ass of himself in California. Before we do, 2018 has been a difficult year for human rights. But have you ever wondered how rights and abuses are documented around the world? You probably have. The sheer volume of global crises we're seeing, from civilian casualties in Syria to ethnic cleansing in Myanmar to the caging of children on U.S. borders, it's critical that we expose the truth in order to defend the rights of all and bring those responsible to justice. Human Rights Watch does just that. They're an independent, nonprofit organization known for their accurate fact-finding, impartial reporting, and targeted advocacy. Often they do so in partnership with local activists and human rights groups. They accept no money from any government, but rely on the support of informed, dedicated people just like you. You've heard us reference Human Rights Watch on this program countless number of times over the years. So if human rights are important to you, visit hrw.org/majority. That's hrw.org/majority to make a donation and support its vital work around the world. When you do, not only is your gift tax deductible, it will be matched dollar for dollar until 2019. That means your donation will go twice as far to advance justice and defend the basic dignity of people who need it most. Again, that's hrw.org/majority. So Donald Trump out in California, Here he is with Gavin Newsom, the California governor elected, I guess lieutenant governor as well. Jerry Brown. I'm not sure who the third person is in camera frame here, but it is Trump is. This is a stunning example of someone who resents California because that's where all the votes came to make him lose the general election tally. And California has the power on things like CAFE standards and whatnot to push back on Donald Trump. And someone who knows nothing about what he's talking about, but feels obligated to pretend that he does. This is a sick individual, but let's hear him. Here he is.
And I know Gavin's committed. We're all committed. I'm committed to make sure that we get all of this cleaned out and protected. Got to take care of the floors, you know, the floors of the forest. Very important. You look at other countries where they do it differently, and it's a whole different story. I was with the president of Finland, and he said, we have a much different, we're a forest nation. He called it a forest nation. And they spent a lot of time on raking and cleaning and doing things, and they don't have any problem. And when it is, it's a very small problem. So I know everybody's looking at that, to that end, and it's going to work out. It's going to work out well.
Yeah, all the adults surrounding him are thinking, this guy's a complete, total moron. For one reason, he's a total moron, is this. This is the average climate of May to October in Finland and California. The red signifying California, the blue, Finland. The numbers on the left, is that the y-axis, is the average precipitation totals between May and October in inches of rain.
Might have something to do with how they rake the floors.
Yes. You will notice that the precipitation in Finland versus California is almost 7 times greater.
And the raking is about 7 times greater as well.
Right. It makes the raking easier. That's the whole point. Because things are looser and you don't, and raking water, there's no.
Maybe if you raked more in California, you'd get more rain.
I would also add that the, is it the Prime Minister of Finland? Has no recollection of that conversation. The President. Reportedly, according to the AP, isn't sure where the U.S. President Donald Trump got the idea that raking is part of his country's routine for managing its substantial forests. The Finnish president said in an interview published Sunday that he spoke briefly with Trump about forest management on November 11th when they were both in Paris for Armistice Day's events. He said the conversation focused on California wildfires and the surveillance system Finland uses to monitor forests for fires. He remembered telling Trump we take care of our forests, but couldn't recall raking coming up. What are you going to say? The guy's a moron. All right, we have more of Donald Trump being a moron in a bit. But first, we're going to take a break, talk to Michael D'Antonio, the co-author with Peter Eisner of The Shadow President, The Truth About Mike Pence. Good time to check in and just remind ourselves what a Mike Pence presidency might look like. We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back after this.
Dear God, hope you got the letter and better down here. I don't mean a big reduction in the price of beer, but all the people that you made in your image, see them starving on their feet, 'cause they don't get enough to eat from.
on the phone. Oh, I'm sorry. We're back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program journalist, CNN contributor, author Michael D'Antonio, author of the latest with Peter Eisner, The Shadow President, The Truth About Mike Pence. Michael, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Sam. Great to be with you.
Now, Michael, we met at Politicon this year on a panel about Mike Pence, and sort of more broadly, I guess, does the left want Mike Pence, or does somebody want Mike Pence to fill in for Donald Trump? And I was, I thought I knew about Mike Pence. I knew a little bit about Mike Pence, but a lot more. And you said something to me, and I want to start here. And then we'll work our way back and forward in Mike Pence's life. But you said something at the time that I found really disturbing, that upon being inaugurated, Mike Pence had become the most powerful Christian, I think you called him, maybe a Reconstructionist in the history of the United States. Did I get that right? Or and if so, correct it. But tell us more about that.
Well, the actual term I used was supremacist, which is an even more disturbing concern. Reconstructionists imagine creating God's dominion on earth and believe that all that they do should be around evangelizing for Christ. But for a supremacist, it also has to do with taking over the government, installing what they believe are biblical values, kind of layering them on top of the Constitution. So in Mike's case, when he was starting out in politics, he would speak to crowds and talk lovingly of America's heritage when there were state churches. Well, in fact, there never were state churches, but there were colonial churches. And one of the main impetuses for the revolution was to get rid of state-sponsored religion. Mike thinks that's a really good idea. Just as he thinks it's a really good idea to roll back marriage equality, to roll back reproductive rights, I think he would even like to see most forms of contraception outlawed as they were prior to the 1970s.
Wow. All right. Well, so Michael, all right. So we have a Christian supremacist who is now, so having established his bona fides as a Christian supremacist, and people understanding what that means, right? I mean, a would be theocrat in many respects. Is he the most powerful? I mean, I guess vice president, right? You're up there.
Yeah, he's up there. And the thing is that there's not been someone so overtly committed to this religious idea of government ever before at this level in our politics. So certainly there have been Christian conservatives. John Ashcroft, as a senator and attorney general, was quite devoted to many of these ideas. But we've never had someone who could, in a moment, become president, and that's really one of the few things required of the vice president, is to be prepared to step in. And he has been preparing for this all of his life, and the people around him all say, well, when the moment comes, Mike will be ready. That's the phrase that they always use, Mike will be ready. And he has salted throughout the government his own folks. Donald Trump arrived in Washington without very many connections and certainly no experience in government, but he leaned on Mike Pence to help him come up with appointments to every department in the government, and often at the very highest levels, there are Pence people in charge who are, I think, more loyal to him than they are to the president.
All right. I want to put a pin in that and come back around to that. But that is the other aspect about this, that Pence is, in some respects, and maybe you know, in some ways, and we'll come back around to this, is reminiscent on some level of Dick Cheney's relationship with George Bush. I don't think it's quite quite analogous, but the power dynamic in terms of personnel seems to me to be a little bit different than maybe we saw with Barack Obama and Joe Biden, or with Bill Clinton and Al Gore. But we'll circle back around to that. Let's go back into Mike Pence's history. A lot of people don't realize this, but Mike Pence was an AM talk radio host, a right-wing talk radio host. I should say, I've got nothing against AM talk radio show hosts, based on my own pedigree. But what was he doing before then? I mean, because this guy was, I think he billed himself as being Rush Limbaugh, but nicer, right?
Precisely. He would say, "I'm a conservative, but I'm not angry about it," or that he was Rush Limbaugh on decaf. And he very much styled himself after Limbaugh. He tried to develop a strong radio voice, and he did develop that. He had a pretty strong personality, but the strength of it was this kind of all-American, I think of cornfields and flapping red, white, and blue flags. He wanted everybody to think that he was a nice guy. So he would say things that were quite radical. For example, he was a big advocate of prosecuting people in the military who formed relationships across rank. So there was a famous case of a woman officer who had an affair with a male officer, and he wanted her put in the brig. These are pretty extreme ideas. He was really worked up about the HIV/AIDS crisis. One of his first sponsors in the radio business, the owner of a radio station that he went on first, was a very wild-eyed preacher who had a lot of street protests against people advocating for equality back in the late 1980s, and was very out there in his radical statements about anybody who was different from him. And what's really fascinating about Mike is he didn't start out this way. He was born into a family that was traditional Irish Catholic. His parents and his grandparents were Democrats. They were really New Dealers. And he saw, I think, when he went off to college, that there was an advantage in being a right-wing evangelical Christian in rural Indiana, which was where he was from and where he would seek his first office.
All right. So, yeah, let's talk about him as a congressman, not terribly effective from a legislative perspective. Is that that seems like, I mean, like an understatement. I mean, I guess you can't get worse than completely ineffective. But he seems to, from a legislative perspective, been completely ineffective.
He was. I mean, he couldn't even get a law passed that went after the problem of child pornography. He was so ineffective in his entire time in Congress, which was 10 years. He didn't pass a single bill. Now, he did manage to elevate himself. He first challenged John Boehner to be speaker, and then sort of as a sop to the Christian right wing of the Republican Party, Boehner invited him into the leadership structure after he defeated him. So he was always about promoting himself, promoting his own power. And he was a reliable vote. So the NRA would have given him 100% grades. The Koch brothers and their organizations favored him. He was a great fundraiser. And this is something people failed to appreciate, is that he raised millions and millions of dollars that he didn't need. So he gave it away. And that's how you make friends in your caucus in the House of Representatives, is you raise lots of extra money, give it to your buddies, they use it in their campaigns. And then when the time arises and you're out campaigning either for, in this case, vice president or eventually president, and I think Mike will campaign for president, they're going to be on your side.
Describe how the development, the relationship with the Koch brothers developed, because the Koch brothers, I shouldn't say this is incongruous in any way. I mean, on some level, I wrote a book in that era about the sort of the free market fundamentalists and just the fundamentalists that basically made up the Republican Party. But he brings them together in some way, Mike Pence does, in his relationship with the Koch brothers. I mean, he is really very much a Koch-funded politician, more than most, and particularly at that time, right?
Right. So this was the old Americans for Prosperity days, when they were one of the very first independent political action committees. They went around the country in 1999 looking for candidates who said the right things, had the right appearance. You know, they wanted good-looking people who stood for a really ferociously independent capitalism, would oppose environmental regulations, do everything that the Koch brothers wanted, and have the chance of getting elected. So among the first two were Jeff Flake and Mike Pence, both of whom succeeded. And they had a similar style. They were kind of blandly good-looking guys who offended almost no one on the stump. But if you listened carefully, what they were saying was pretty extreme. And they were reliable votes in that pro-business, anti-regulation arena throughout their careers. One of the strangest things that Mike did in this period was he had a column that ran in local papers, and he wrote a column saying that there was absolutely no evidence that there were health effects from smoking. So this was in 1999. So by then, there were only about 300 papers that had established a firm connection between smoking and cancer. The number of deaths related to smoking were well established. But little known to many people was that not only was this a great anti-regulation position, you know, you could say that you were 100% against government regulation if you're standing up for tobacco, but Mike's family ran a chain of 200 convenience store gas stations where tobacco was a major profit source. So he's at one point standing up for the Koch brothers, but he's also standing up for his family's business and all the money that they were making on cigars and cigarettes and chewing tobacco every single day.
Well, Michael, I'm sure you're aware that charity starts at home.
Well, here's another funny thing that he has in common with Donald Trump. So you mentioned that he was a broadcaster, and this was before Trump was a broadcaster. And actually, Mike was on television in Indiana in addition to being on the radio long before Donald was on the boss on The Apprentice. Mike was the host of this TV show. But he also, his family went through one of the biggest bankruptcies in the history of the state of Indiana business. I believe that it was well over $100 million that they walked away from, leaving not only suppliers and vendors on the hook, but the state of Indiana. They were left with millions of dollars in cleanup costs at gas stations where the Pence companies had poured all kinds of things into the ground. So he's got both broadcasting and bankruptcy and all sorts of other tricks in common with Donald Trump. So there's not as much difference between them as people would like to believe.
So in the, I can't remember if it was the late aughts, mid-aughts, he leaves Congress to run for governor. Must have been late aughts, I guess, or maybe just in like 2010, is it? I mean, because he was an extremely, by the end of his first term, and he was going to try and run for re-election when he became vice president, he was unpopular. He was significantly unpopular, if I remember correctly.
He was. So he left 12 and ran for governor of Indiana then. A Republican in that state kind of starts out with a huge advantage because the registration favors them, and you almost have to try to lose, and he almost did lose. But he got into office and then proceeded to do all kinds of stuff that nobody liked. And one of the main things that he did that really alienated not only great swaths of the electorate, but the Republican establishment, was this thing called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, or RFRA. And what this was a law that said it's okay to discriminate on the basis of sexual identity. So if you were running a business and someone came in to buy invitations for a same-sex wedding or a wedding cake, or really if they had any view that was different from yours on a religious basis, you could refuse to serve them. And he actually got this through the state legislature and signed it. And the thing, everything sort of hit the fan when a picture from the signing ceremony, which was held in secret, was actually released. And if you looked at this photo, you'd see something that was kind of a modern-day Last Supper painting, with Mike seated at his desk with his pen in hand, surrounded by preachers and Catholic nuns and Orthodox Jewish people, all fully recognizable from their clothing. And the state erupted. You know, the conservative Indianapolis newspaper ran one headline on the front page, and it was in huge type, and it just said, "Fix this," because businesses were saying they were going to move out of the state. The NCAA was saying it was going to no longer hold tournaments in Indianapolis. It was a disaster, and he backtracked on it as quickly as he could.
And we should say, I mean, ultimately, on a federal level, it was the federal RFRA that was almost like revived in some respects in the Hobby Lobby case. Where the ACA, where RFRA was basically used, if I'm not mistaken, as the sort of the leverage point in allowing for Hobby Lobby as a closely held business not to have to offer certain health insurance benefits to its employees because it was offensive to the owner's religion. And so, go ahead.
Well, this was Mike being a little bit ahead of his time. You know, he wanted to do this by statute, and the case involving the ACA wound up being a Supreme Court case, and now it's more. There's more leverage for businesses that want to withhold either insurance coverage for contraception, or if you don't want to bake a wedding cake, they have some standing to do so on religious grounds. But the law Mike pushed through in Indiana was much broader than that, and would essentially allowed anybody to refuse service to almost anyone else and claim that it was a religious cause.
There seems to be a series of instances like this where he overreaches and then has to walk it back, essentially. I specifically I'm thinking about a situation where it was a case I had interviewed actually an attorney about it, where at one point he and his Department of Adoption Services, or I can't remember, like Child Welfare Services in the state, basically cut the funding to foster parents parents who adopt kids with special needs. There was no federal funding, and the state cut the subsidies in like 2009, I think it was. They ultimately were sued. He had to sort of reinstitute those payments. But what's going on here? Like what? There's just a series of these things. Because on one hand, that paints him as a guy who's like, I just am deeply religious, and I have these principles that are nuts to a large segment of the population, even in my home state. But I go forward until I'm slapped back. But then we have a vision of a far more mercenary guy, it seems to me, who it has become vice president.
Well, you're right. And it's a good observation that on some of these cases, it does seem to be religiously motivated. But in other cases, it's this overstepping almost as a matter of wielding power and refusing to compromise. There were two really important examples of this while he was governor. One was a case in northwestern Indiana, which is up toward Chicago and tends to be Democratic, where there was a crisis similar to the Flint water crisis. It was primarily an African-American community where a industry had polluted the ground and the water so terribly that people were getting sick and a huge housing project had to be shut down. And Mike refused to intervene, refused to give them disaster assistance, just insisted there was nothing wrong and that he did not have to act. There was another infamous case of a wrongful conviction and incarceration of a man for murder who all the evidence indicated he hadn't done it, and it was proven that he hadn't done it, and he was released, and he wanted his record wiped clean so that he would not have the conviction show up anywhere in his record. And Mike just flatly refused to do it, really for no good reason. And as soon as he was out of office, his lieutenant governor became governor and reversed him on both of those issues. So, and he was a good regular Republican governor of the state of Indiana, and he saw no reason to hold on to these policies when clearly the people in East Chicago, which was the community that was affected by the pollution, needed to have that redressed. And the man who had been incarcerated had become a cause célèbre for the entire state. And they're really, what's amazing about this is it's sort of like the case with the border separations and Trump, where even Franklin Graham Jr. was saying, you know, we can't abide this separation of these children and their parents. And Trump said, I'm still going to go forward with it. In Indiana, there were evangelical leaders who were telling Mike to change his position, and he just wouldn't.
So Mike Pence came to us via Paul Manafort, and I think there is a story that has been reported in multiple places that Manafort brought Trump in to look at Pence as vice president, that Trump was leaning towards Chris Christie. And Manafort pretended that the jet that brought Trump in was broken and that they had to stay overnight so that he would have more time with Mike Pence. I can understand the theory, right? Like Mike Pence, the theory was Mike Pence is going to deliver the evangelical vote, that the Trump essentially hiring Mike Pence as vice president was the metaphor. Like I'm bringing you folks into the tent. I will do your bidding, and therefore it's worth it for you to come out and vote for me, if only because of what I'll do with the Supreme Court. But more. I mean, is that basically the dynamic that was going on there?
That is the dynamic, and there is a whole theological backdrop for all of this, where people talk about the biblical story of Cyrus and the fact that as a non-believer king, he allowed a Jewish man to be his key advisor, and he protected the Jews in Cyrus's kingdom and allowed, encouraged Cyrus to act in a just manner and to therefore serve God. And this is taught in Christian right churches today that Donald Trump is Cyrus, and Pence is the person who will moderate him and mediate on God's behalf and usher in the kingdom, despite the fact that there is this awful person in the Oval Office. So none of what Trump does, none of the sins that he's committed in the past, none of the outrages that he continues to commit matter, because Mike Pence has his eye on him. And Pence believes that he's destined to be president and that God intends for that to happen anyway. And I think most of the Christian right world assumes that this will be the case too. So he's in this caretaker position, kind of looking over Trump's shoulder. His obsequiousness, you know, the fact that he's the sycophant in chief, is all part of the game. It doesn't matter how much he degrades himself, how much he grovels in front of Trump's awfulness. He's there for one purpose, and that's why the Christian right is going to remain loyal to the president.
There's a little bit of that, like, lying for the Lord quality to that.
Absolutely. That's a concept that is very current in the conservative Christian movement. And, you know, popes have subscribed to this as well, that any amount of deception for the right purpose is somehow permissible. So the ends justify the means, even among the pious.
Let's, because I want to get to just like how much of an actionable plan do you think Mike Pence has to assume the presidency? I want to get to that in a second. But before we do, let's talk about the personnel in the White House, because I look at like this guy, Matt Whitaker, who has been who went from chief of staff for Jeff Sessions to now the acting attorney general. And this guy, when his whole sort of biblical reference for the law and a litmus test for judges need to be Christian, and the story that Whitaker came not from Jeff Sessions, but from outside of Jeff Sessions and was more or less installed there and became Donald Trump's eyes and ears, it occurred to me that he sounds like maybe he came from Mike Pence, because it doesn't sound like this guy came from anywhere else. I mean, do you have a sense of that? Like, how many people in the White House now are Pence people that we're not really clear about?
Well, there are people in the White House, most notably this fellow Nick Ayers, who is right now Mike Pence's chief of staff, but is in the running to replace Kelly as the president's chief of staff. But more important where Pence is concerned are the people who are cabinet secretaries. You know, someone like Ben Carson is more a Pence loyalist than a Trump loyalist. The people at Department of Agriculture, HHS, Alex Azar, was Pence's guy in Indiana for Health and Human Services. You can go down a long list of people, not only in the administration, but people who have been named to be federal judges whose pathway to these appointments is through the vice president's office. In fact, a lot of the judges have been vetted not in the West Wing, but by the vice president's office. So there's this very much a kind of shadow administration that serves Donald Trump. And, you know, the other thing to consider is that Trump's not much interested in this stuff. He's not a guy who cares much about
right.
policy. He, you know, when he says that he doesn't know who Matt Whitaker was, well, that's a lie. You know, it just chalk that up to one of the half a dozen lies a day that he commits. But I'm sure he doesn't really care who Matt Whitaker was in the past, only that he saw him on Fox TV trying out for the role by saying that Mueller's off the reservation and needs to be reined in, and that the investigation is based on nothing and is a fraud. So he made it clear to the president where he stood. As a guy from Iowa, I think Whitaker would have been on Pence's radar. Years ago, before Donald Trump even considered running for president in 2016, Mike Pence was working in Iowa and New Hampshire and South Carolina to develop his primary and caucus state contacts for his own run for president. So Whitaker would have been on his radar, as would have been Sam Clovis, who's another controversial figure in the Department of Agriculture and is Whitaker's buddy in Iowa.
Right.
So there is this reality that you're going to find more connections between Pence and the players in the Trump administration that go back deeper than for the president and any of these figures.
How much of a plan do you imagine that Mike Pence has to become president? I mean, let me delineate it this way. Obviously, he is contemplating the idea of running as a sitting vice president, maybe in 2024, right? Does he have a plan? And I imagine he's, you know, ready if the Lord decides that Donald Trump needs to go in some fashion, that Pence is ready to step in. But do you think that Mike Pence, like when we saw that letter that was released weeks before the midterm elections from an anonymous source within somewhere in the administration, I doubt it was Mike Pence writing this thing, but to what extent do you think that he had any close proximity to the writer or awareness that this was going to be written? A and B, that's another way of asking, like, does Mike Pence also have a, maybe we can expedite this or have the chips fall in a certain way plan?
Well, he's a pretty ruthless guy. For all of his milquetoast exterior and claiming to be so nice and promoting the president, when he sees his opportunities, he grabs them. And I would be very surprised if the vice president didn't know that that anonymous letter was coming. And I really have to assume that he knows who wrote it and is not unhappy about the fact that it was published. He's currently in Asia and the Pacific representing the president at various meetings, and he's made it clear there that he disagrees with Trump when it comes to the press as the enemy of the people. He has cultivated some space between himself and the president and a niche that suggests that he's a little bit more normal and that he's an alternative to Trump, maybe even a transition figure back toward politics as it regularly was before this great disruption. So I think he's constantly positioning himself. He created his own super PAC in May of 2017, 5 months into the vice presidency. No one ever did that before. He's raised huge sums of money. He spent more time on the road talking to local Republicans than the president has, and we know how much he enjoys going around doing rallies. So his network continues to develop and grow. The expectations for him in the future are greater than they ever were. I actually think Nikki Haley left the United Nations to prepare herself to be on a Pence Haley ticket in 2024. So we've not seen anything yet from Mike Pence.
Wow. Well, that seems like a good place to wrap this up. Michael D'Antonio, the book is The Shadow President, The Truth About Mike Pence. You know what? Before we go, I got to ask this. Okay. I think people not of the fundamentalist ilk look upon Mike Pence's relationship with his wife as, at the very least, anachronistic, I guess, right? And what do we know about Mike Pence? Like how, I think there's a facile response to that, like Mike Pence, is really, really concerned about, maintaining control over his sexual urges, which may be, all over the place to a certain extent. Is there anything beyond the fact that this, in the course of your reporting, that Mike Pence is anything other than, more or less the type of guy who would walk out of The Handmaid's Tale?
Well, he's obviously a very repressed guy. There's so much effort being made at containing and controlling his sexuality, his emotions, that you have to think that there's some fear there, that he's worried about those aspects of being a human being. When he asked Karen to marry him, he told friends that he had to forgive her for not being a virgin because she had been married before. So this goes way back. I think his fear of passion and sexuality and perhaps women is well established. I think the president's fear of women is well established. That's why he's so angry at them and tries to belittle women at every chance he gets. Beyond that, I think that the Pences have this meeting of the minds where she's every bit as ambitious as he is. He respects her judgment politically, and in a lot of ways, they're sort of like, surprise, surprise, Bill and Hillary Clinton. They're a power couple. They've pursued these ambitions together, and I think she takes every bit as much pleasure from the exercise of power and the achievements that he's notched in his career as he does.
That's interesting. I just saw a screening of Vice about Dick Cheney, and the relationship between Lynn Cheney and Dick Cheney is every much as much a shared venture. In some respects, Dick Cheney, by the account of this film, is a Lynn Cheney project. It's striking in many respects. But Michael D'Antonio, the book is The Shadow President, The Truth About Mike Pence. We'll put a link to that at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Sam.
All right, folks. Going to head into the fun half, wherein we will play. Let's play one more clip of Donald Trump being a complete just moron. I mean, I can only imagine the sense of, someone like Jerry Brown walking around being, a normal human being, and all the other people there, obviously, as well, being a normal human being, being aware of the human suffering that's going around, being aware of the implications of climate change and how it is likely that what they're witnessing is not a one-off incident, but a continuance of a trajectory and a glimpse into the future of what's going to be going on in California. And then to be sitting there with this moron who has no human empathy, but an intense desire to appear as if he knows what he's talking about, but exercising not even the slightest bit of effort to do so. I've been in some rather uncomfortable situations where I've been sitting around people I don't like, but I've never had to do this, frankly. Here he is. This is him talking about him being in pleasure, right? Is that it? Yeah. They're in a place called Paradise, California. Here is Donald Trump trying to remember that.
You don't really see the gravity of it. I mean, as big as they look on the tube, you don't see what's going on until you come here. And what we saw at Pleasure, what a name right now. But when what we just saw, we just left Pleasure for Paradise. And what we just saw at Paradise is just, it's just not acceptable.
Right. Pleasure, Paradise. Two different.
I can see why I'd make the mistake.
It starts with a P. It starts with a P. Here is Donald Trump also showing his ignorance as to, he's already earlier said, you know, Finland doesn't have this problem. Why do we have this problem? Finland, like we already expressed, has 2 to 3 times more precipitation. Or no, it was 7 times more precipitation during the months of May to October, which will, I mean, for those of you who are Trump supporters, that much rain and precipitation will make the starting of forest fires that much less likely and the intensity of those fires much less so because things aren't as dry. Here is Donald Trump addressing the likelihood that climate change has implications for creating essentially really dry environment in California that would lead to intense forest fires.
Does seeing this devastation, though, change your opinion at all on climate change, Mr. President?
No. I have a strong opinion. I want great climate. We're going to have that, and we're going to have forests that are very safe because we can't go through this every year. We go through this, so we're going to have safe forests, and that's happening as we speak.
You said you need to change the fire management. Should the state and local officials have done
it? No, we're going to work together with the federal government. No, state, local, and federal government. The federal government's going to work with the state and local, and we're going to help them with funding. And it's going to take a lot of funding, I will tell you.
Should they have done things differently before this point?
A lot of things have been learned. A lot of things have been learned. And they've been working very hard, and I think you're going to see something very spectacular over the next number of years.
I mean, this guy has one macro for all these things. We're going to have great climate. It's already, the climate's getting better.
That's his favorite mode. This is the same mode he was in when he was throwing paper towels out in Puerto Rico.
Strutting around, getting to wear the coat, the USA hat.
It's so much about containment for him as well. Like the idea that we can make safe forests.
We're going to have a safe forest, right. The forests are going to be great. They're going to be safe. It's happening. It's already happening. We're probably 3 weeks. 6 to 3 weeks. 3 to 6 weeks. Great forests. Happy, safe for us. And he, you know, in that moment where he's close to Jerry Brown, right? Lessons have been learned. Nobody knew about fires until I became president.
It's a constant balancing act between saying what he knows he should be obligated to say and also covering his own tracks.
Yep. All right, folks, just a reminder, this program relies on its members for its very existence. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. By becoming a member of the program, you are supporting this show. You are making it possible for us to have interviews. We had a lot of great response from the interviews we had last week. That was one of my favorite weeks, I have to say. Yochai Benkler on what the media has been up to, and John Sides on the implications of race in our country following Obama and Marcy Wheeler. Covered all bases last week. Really great stuff. The best interviews. And we're going to have even better interviews. They're going to just get better.
A lot of things were learned.
A lot of things were learned, and we're going to have a lot better ones in like 3 to 6 weeks.
Everyone knows that, and it almost wouldn't even have to be said.
That's right. But you can support this program by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. And as a way of saying thank you, we give you extra content every day. So if there is one of those rare times where you find the interview too dry, too weedy, I know I have a tendency to do that. People have told me that sometimes repeatedly over and over. Some people have told me that. But that's just the way that we do it here.
It's kind of like that chart that we just showed earlier with the Norway, California. It's dry. There's some drier stuff.
There's some drier stuff. That's right.
More wet stuff.
More wet stuff. But yeah, I mean, I've been told in the past, like, you should do the fun half as the free show in the interviews. But no, it's not the way I want to do it. So you can support the show by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, you can see us live. We're still debating about guests. January 13th in Brooklyn, New York, we will be at the Bell House. We have a link on the majority.fm and in the podcast, and we'll put it down below in the YouTube as well. Part of the Brooklyn Pod Fest. Tickets are only $15. It is 18 and over. So if you're a young person, come to the show. And we may have guests, we may not. Not sure. But does it matter? Does it really matter? Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code, get 10% off with the coupon code majority. TMBS put out two shows this week or last week. So go catch up on that. You can get it as a podcast on where all your podcasts are delivered, or you can go to the YouTube channel, youtube.com/Sam Cedar, watch the full show, clips on the TMBS channel, and obviously head over to Patreon too if you want to support that program. The Antifada.
They had a giant episode.
That was the guy who'd gone undercover on the alt-right, right?
I don't even know if that's the most recent one.
Patreon.com/ The Antifada. Literary Hangover.
Yeah, another episode on Catherine Maria Sedgwick. We look into, there's a common thing in colonial times where colonialists would go into Native American tribes and they would stay there. And it wouldn't so much happen the other way around because apparently the lifestyle was just better or something like that, you have to infer. Catherine Maria Sedgwick had an ancestor who was captured by Native Americans and then married into it and stayed a Native American. She preferred it. So we talk a little bit about that and about the rest of the story.
Check that all out. Head into the fun app, 646-257-3920. Oh, I'm going to talk about a libertarian debate that we're going to have coming up, too. We will talk about that in the fun half, 646-257-3920. See you there. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous. You're a little bit upset. You're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27.
One half. 5/8. 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd, don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance. My first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
You think I might be a Nazi?
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.